your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now with your host, Rick Moore.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. Very exciting, important educational program lined up. Our guest today, Dr. Nathan Fountain, UVA professor of neurology. And we're going to be talking about epilepsy, and we're doing it because of businesses like Dixon Disposal that allow us to be on air. Dixon reminds you that you can reduce household garbage by purchasing products with reuse and recycling in mind. Small changes in your lifestyle can keep our planet green for years to come. When Dixon's picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. Phone is 978-2111. Online, DixonDisposal.com. All right, back, let's introduce our guest by pushing all the right buttons. Dr. Fountain, how are you?
Just fine. Thank you for having me today. Well, it's an honor to be here.
It's thank you for coming on. Not everybody wants to give up the hour on their Sunday. We will be talking about epilepsy. Not many people, I mean, for many, let me rephrase that. For many people, epilepsy has the face of a child having a seizure. But there's a lot more to it than that. But Dr. Fountain, let's start by giving a little bit of basic information to those who are listening, because it's a much greater and grander scheme. It's a problem, number of people who suffer. And let's start with that. The number of people who suffer and what sort of percentage it is.
That's a great question. It's really underappreciated by almost everyone. But yet, as a medical problem, it's really common. About 10% of people, so that means 1 out of 10 people, will have a seizure at some time in their life. About 3% of people will develop epilepsy, and epilepsy is the spontaneous recurrence of seizures, so anything that gives you seizures is epilepsy. And then about 1% of people will have epilepsy at any one time, and will have seizures that continue at least intermittently. So although you might say 1%, that means 99% of people don't, but we're talking about a medical problem. So compare that to other things. There are very few medical problems that affect up to 1% of the population on any given day. And of course, then the next question might be, well, what are you talking about? What is a seizure? What is epilepsy? And seizures are an electrical storm of the brain. And when your brain has an electrical storm, the thing that most people are familiar with is it grabs the whole brain. A generalized tonic-clonic seizure used to be called a grand mal seizure, in which someone gets stiff all over and falls to the ground and jerks. And that's what most people think of, but actually any part of your brain could have an electrical storm, could be any one small part. If just a small part of your brain that controls motor movement has a seizure or a storm, then it'll just cause jerking, and someone will be otherwise fine. They'll say, hey, look, my hand's jerking. That's a seizure. Or it could affect just the speech part of the brain, in which they'd just be unable to talk for a few minutes and have no other problems. And epilepsy just means having seizures. And, of course, you're right, it does tend to have the face of children. And it tends to have the face of children because that's the most dramatic effects, children that are born with other brain disorders that gives them things like cerebral palsy or mental retardation. And this is the situation that seizures can be most severe and difficult to control. And it's the face that most people might associate because it can be so dramatic. But in fact, it's actually overall more common in adults because it's, of course, more common to be an adult than a child.
What makes it happen? I mean, you talk about an electrical, you know, storm in the brain, but how does that happen? I can understand that part. What makes it happen?
That's a terrific question. For the vast majority of people that have epilepsy, they're perfectly fine until they have a seizure. So they're going about their normal daily activities, and then seemingly out of the blue, this little electrical storm happens, or maybe a big electrical storm, and interrupts their day with a seizure that lasts just a minute or two, and then it stops and goes away, and after they recover, they're perfectly fine again. And the question is, why did it happen today at 11:05 instead of 5 minutes ago or 5 minutes from now? And the most common answer for most people is we don't know. But there are some things that trigger it. So there are some people that only have seizures in response to specific situations that are triggered by certain specific things. Sometimes it's very common things like flashing lights or video games. Sometimes it's unusual things like hearing a certain music or tone. There's a particularly famous one for some of the older listeners. There was the Mary Hartman show, and there was sort of a famous person, patient, that had a seizure each time she heard the Mary Hartman theme. So, for example, it could be something very specific like that, or there's another person. I followed a person who had seizures in response to the theme to the X-Files. And remember, these are episodes that someone has no control over. It's not, they're not crazy, they're not faking it, they're not having a fit like falling down and getting angry. It's something that captures their brain when it has this electrical storm that we can measure on the EEG and then goes away. So it's not something that you'd normally think would be influenced by your everyday activities.
Our guest today, Dr. Nathan Fountain, UVA professor of neurology, and we're speaking about epilepsy. Dr. Fountain, an epileptologist. It only took me about 5 years to properly pronounce that, and I'm sure I'll mess it up throughout the hour. It is 11:06 here on WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. And the goal today is not just to educate people who do not suffer from epilepsy or do not have anyone in their family who suffers. And Dr. Fountain has already told us that 1 in 10 people as the grand percentage. But is it genetic? I mean, is it a higher percentage of people because the grandmother has it and passes it on, sort of like twins, right? The twins, you're more likely to have twins if someone in your family already had twins, or you're more likely to have diabetes if the grandparent had it. Or is it more evenly spread out throughout the community?
That's another great question.
All my questions are great, so let's just dive into the
reason it's such a great question that I say is because it's so timely. We're just now starting a study, an NIH-funded multi-center study, to look into that kind of question. But you have to back up a little bit to talk about what is a seizure. Well, the seizures, as I said, it's an electrical storm in the brain, but it's really just a symptom of something going on. It's kind of like when you have a cough. A cough is a symptom of something wrong with your lungs. Well, a seizure is a symptom of something wrong with your brain. And that thing that's wrong with your brain could be something you acquired, like trauma, if you were in a motor vehicle accident or if you'd had a stroke. Or it could be some underlying genetic predisposition. In the same way that you might have a lung disease because you got pneumonia, because you acquired an infection, or you're born with something wrong with your lungs that gives you a cough. So some types of epilepsy are definitely genetic and are strongly inherited, and other types are not. The most common kind of epilepsy is not directly inherited, but it does seem as though there's some genetic predisposition. So it is a bit like twins. Twins aren't passed through directly from generation to generation, but if you have a family history of twins, you're more likely to have twins. In the same way as if you have a strong family history of epilepsy, you're more likely to have epilepsy, but not definitely unless you have one of these known genetic syndromes.
And again, as we sort of lay the groundwork for the topic, women versus men, or is that a concern? Not just for having it, but for dealing with it, because women are going to get pregnant. Women, you know, and the other things that make women and men different as they go through life.
That's true. Overall, epilepsy is approximately equally distributed among men and women, although it's different depending on the cause and a few circumstances. So there are a few that are inherited and only occur in women, and some that are more likely to occur sort of in men. But overall, you're right, the main issue is about its treatment, because women have some unique concerns. The particular unique concerns have to do with, for women of reproductive age or reproductive potential, in other words, they have to do with pregnancy, becoming pregnant, being pregnant, and having children. And in particular, women who are on seizure medications, that is, medicines to suppress seizures, for some medicines have an increased risk of birth defects. And in for at least one of those medicines, the risk is so high that we try to take women off those medicines. On the other hand, there's certainly a risk that seizures will cause problems like birth defects, and consequently, we need to keep people, women, on medications to prevent seizures. They don't have seizures. So it's often a balance. The good news is that for the medicines that we know about, the relatively modern medicines, the risk of birth defects is low, but it's important for women to plan their pregnancy so they can do very simple things like take vitamins like folic acid to help reduce the risk of birth defects and get proper prenatal care.
But how does it, I mean, you talk about women planning their pregnancy. There are certainly many men and women for whom pregnancy and births are not planned, or people who plan and then are unable during the planning time to have a child. So does the medication, how does the medicine affect someone who is not planning and the pregnancy happens, or for someone who reduces the medicine because they want to have children and then are unable to do so? Does that mean that they are more likely to have a seizure because they've changed or altered the medicine that they're on?
That's different for each person, so it's really important for each person considering that to discuss it with their neurologist. And the reason is because it's all a series of balancing the risks and benefits of each decision. As a general principle, though, the principle is that women should be on the lowest dose that's effective of the medication they're taking and the fewest number of medications, because we know that birth defects are, the risk of birth defects are increased when you're on two seizure medicines compared to one. For most seizure medicines, the risk is not substantially increased with one seizure medicine, with just one or two exceptions. So overall, the first principle is the lowest dose of the most effective medicine. The second principle about that has to do with planning is to take things like folic acid. But even if it's not planned at the time that a pregnancy is discovered, then it's important to do those same things, like take folic acid. And then, of course, to think through the pregnancy to after the baby's delivered what to do, because there's some other very simple things people can do to make life less stressful and safer. Like, for instance, tell women that they shouldn't change their baby unrestrained on a high changing table, because if they have a seizure, the baby maybe could roll off or fall off. On the other hand, of course, that's probably good advice for everybody.
We are talking about epilepsy here with Dr. Nathan Fountain from UVA, past president of the Epilepsy Foundation of Virginia. And what's your proper title from the Dreyfus Clinic?
Director of the F.E. Dreyfus Comprehensive Epilepsy Program.
Here at the university. And again, just a follow-up question about women being pregnant. What about breastfeeding? Are you passing anything along to a child?
The good news is that for most seizure medications, because of course we're talking in generalities, the amount in breast milk is relatively low. There are a few medications that the amount is higher, and there would be two philosophies on that. In general, it's better for babies to breastfeed than to not breastfeed, so that's the place to start. On the other hand, we don't know enough benefits about breastfeeding to outweigh what might be risks of not breastfeeding, to using formula, for instance. So my opinion would be that if there's any reason not to breastfeed, I'd be quick to move to that. On the other hand, there's relatively low amounts of seizure medication that gets into breast milk.
All right. So I feel like we're good with the basic information on epilepsy. And for those who are listening, we will be opening up the phone lines in another 5 minutes or so. Write down the number 979-0919 for your questions, personal, family-wise, or just informational with Dr. Fountain today. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. And I can see somebody's already taken me up on that. Dr. Fountain, though, there are plenty of controversial issues to go along with epilepsy. There was something in the news just in the past month or two about how a Virginia public school would not allow a student who had a service dog, which apparently could sense the seizure coming, and the school would not allow the student to bring the seizure dog with him. I believe it was a male student. Talk a little bit about that.
In Northern Virginia and Alexandria, there's a boy that has relatively severe epilepsy and other kinds of learning, as other conditions of epilepsy, including learning disabilities and things like that. And he does have a seizure alert dog. What happens is that the dog senses when he's going to have a seizure at the very moment the seizure occurs, seemingly. And then as the boy falls down or sits down, the dog's able to come to the to the boy's aid. And you might say, well, what's he do? Well, in the usual situation for seizure alert dogs, they simply sit by the person and keep them safe and make sure no one bothers them. In this case, the dog actually licks the boy's face. And when the dog licks the boy's face, the dog's wearing a collar with a magnet. And the magnet swipes across the boy's chest. And implanted in the boy's chest is a generator that stimulates the vagus nerve in the neck, called a vagus nerve stimulator. And for some people with vagus nerve stimulators, when it's activated during a seizure, it aborts the seizure. And that's the case for him. So this very clever addition to what's a traditional seizure alert dog actually not only keeps the boy safe by keeping people away who might accidentally cause some harm, but in addition activates the vagus nerve stimulator to help abort the seizure. And the reason that the school system doesn't want the dog in the school is because they only allow service dogs, that is dogs to provide help for people with disabilities, is because they only allow them when the dog is certified through a certain program, and this dog was certified through a different program, specifically for seizure alert dogs. So I think that's kind of the crux of the issue, although I haven't been involved in that particular case, so I don't know any of the details.
But my understanding is also that they have recently changed their policy. I don't know if they've changed their policy, but they have allowed the service dog to attend school with the student, although I don't know that that's a set decision or one that they have made while they further look through everything, you know, their everything that happens and why they should or should not change their decision.
Yeah, I think they're test driving it would be the case. And it really does speak to the larger issue about why people are so nervous about epilepsy and seizures. Among all the medical conditions that one might have, on the one hand, you might say epilepsy is the most simple. People are otherwise perfectly fine. They have a seizure. They're unlikely to have it in front of you. They're unlikely to have any other problems. Yet when they do have a seizure, it makes people extremely nervous because they can be dramatic to watch. They're very unpleasant, and the person watching often feels helpless, and they feel like someone having a seizure is going to die right there. Now, fortunately, people hardly ever die during a seizure. Seizures just run their course and stop most often. But the people around them feel so helpless and anxious that it makes them create this stigma in their mind about not wanting to be around people with epilepsy. And so I think we have to just take a step back and look at that rationally. Now, historically, there are lots of other stigmas associated with epilepsy, like being possessed or having other demonic qualities. And of course, in some cultures, it's actually seen as a positive thing, speaking in tongues and having a particular religious experience. So my point is just that it's dramatic to watch, and that creates what seems like an undue concern about it.
11:18 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about epilepsy, sort of the facts and fears, and some of the controversies as well, with Dr. Nathan Fountain from the University of Virginia. Let me give you today's weather. Markets of Tigerfuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly sunny and windy today. Highs in the lower 30s. Even colder in the valley, where upper 20s. Mostly cloudy and windy tonight. Lows 11 to 16. Valley as low as 9. Partly cloudy tomorrow. Highs 30 to 35. A little warmer in Lynchburg and Richmond. Right now, it's a fair but chilly day out there. 30 in the valley, 33 in Lynchburg, 32 in Richmond, 33 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And there are lots of radio stations and other music sources out there, but only one that brings you programs like The Wake Up Call. And the only reason we do it is because of listeners like Angie Fink, John Herman, Betty Graham, all who supported us in the fun drive in the fall. It's also because of program underwriters, the ones you're hearing this hour, as well as Hamilton's and Angelo Jewelry. So stay tuned, tell a friend about The Wake Up Call, another programming you enjoy here on WNRN, and be sure to support us in the fun drive coming up this March. I also need to thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to be here today. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville. They provide custom t-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, brgtshirts.com. Dr. Fountain, you talk about people being helpless when they see someone having the seizure. What is the proper thing to do?
They certainly feel helpless, but of course they're not actually helpless because they can provide assistance. The first thing to know is to, if someone'sal a generalized tonic-clonic seizure, a grand mal seizure, that is they fall down and jerk all over, then in that case the thing not to do is to not put anything in the mouth. Everyone's concerned that someone might swallow their tongue, but of course your tongue is attached in your mouth. You can't actually swallow it. But I think a more legitimate concern is that tongue occludes the airway and someone might not be able to breathe. Fortunately, that almost never happens during a seizure, but it sounds like it happens because during a seizure like that, it's as though someone's just run a 100-yard dash. Most of us aren't used to just popping out of a chair and doing that, and consequently, afterwards, their body's exhausted, as is their brain. And so consequently, they make these snoring kind of sounds because they actually are asleep. And during that time, then someone might think that they're not able to breathe right. But the best way to deal with that is simply to roll them onto their side. And when that happens, then for most people, it'll open up their airway and they'll breathe normally. But overall, the best thing to do as far as their airway goes is to leave them alone until the seizure stops. If the seizure stops after a minute or two, as it almost always will, then they'll gradually recover. But there are a few other things that you can do. First of all, you don't want them to hurt themselves so that if you can see it coming, you can lower them to the ground so they don't fall. If they're already on the ground, you can put something under their head so they don't bang their head on the ground if they're having jerking movements. And if they're rubbing their arm or leg against the carpet, you don't want them to get a carpet burn, so you can simply put something under that or roll them to the side or move them into a position where they won't get hurt. So the most important thing is prevent harm, either you harming them or them accidentally harming themselves.
We did get a phone call here, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. We got a call from Margaret in Charlottesville. Dr. Fountain, certain mental health diseases such as bipolar condition can be treated with anti-seizure meds. Can you talk about that and the impact of these meds leading to birth defects?
It's interesting that these medicines that were originally studied for seizures, actually some of them have a wider use for other indications. There's a medicine called Topamax, that's its brand name, topiramate's its generic name. It was studied and is used for seizures, but also is very good at preventing migraine headaches, and its widest use is to treat migraine headaches. There's another medicine for seizures called Lamictal, its brand name is Lamotrigine. I mean, its generic name is Lamotrigine, and it actually has a wider use for other problems like bipolar disorder, as the caller mentioned. So it's true that a lot of seizure medicines are useful in treating certain psychiatric disease, particularly bipolar disease, depression, and as well as other in terms of related conditions for headache.
What about in leading towards any birth defects?
Well, in regard to the same risk that the medicines have for people with epilepsy, also the same risk for others, so that an older seizure medicine called Depakote, its brand name, valproic acid or valproate, its generic name, does have an increased risk of birth defects, and that's true whether you take it for seizures or whether you take it for bipolar disorder or whether you take it for headaches. Whatever you take it for, there's an increased risk of birth defects. On the other hand, certain other medicines, such as Lamictal or Lamotrigine, that one that I mentioned before, doesn't, in my opinion and in most research, doesn't have a substantial increased risk of birth defects, regardless of what you take it for, whether for seizures or bipolar or something else.
Is that apply for men and women? Do these medications work genetically for the man passing it on, or is it strictly through the female who is hosting the child for
right.
9 months?
As far as we know, the risk is to the child from direct exposure while the child is in the womb, and consequently there wouldn't seem to be a mechanism for it passing it on from men to the child.
We are talking about epilepsy here with Dr. Nathan Fountain, UVA professor of neurology. Dr. Fountain, you mentioned several drugs in that last answer to the caller, by the way. Call up if you'd like, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's the toll-free number. I have the computer next to me if you'd like to send the instant message to WNRN Studio at the AOL site. But you mentioned several drugs, and you mentioned their generic name. Talk about generic versions of these. I haven't hidden the fact to those regular listeners that I suffer from epilepsy, although we set this up months and months ago. Some of the drugs that I have tried changed to a generic version. Do they? And I've never understood how that works. The same drug that I am given to try to reduce the seizures and then it becomes a generic version. When I go to the grocery store, if I want to buy, you know, the brand name of whatever, the juice, I pay less, and the juice is expected to be a lesser quality, at least to many people, if you buy the grocery store version.
I think that analogy is really very good. And this, of course, applies not just to those with epilepsy, but anyone that takes medication for anything, whether it's for high blood pressure, for high cholesterol, or anything else. The difference and unique problem for epilepsy is that the tolerance for changes in blood levels of medication can be very low. For example, if you have high blood pressure and you take a brand name medication for it, and it controls your blood pressure, and then because it's cheaper, you switch to a generic and your blood pressure goes up a little bit, it's not a big deal. You just later switch to back to the brand name or to something else or increase the dose because you've detected it when your blood pressure goes up. The same would be true of diabetes. If your blood sugar goes up, you just change back to the brand name. But for people with epilepsy, for most people, the only manifestation is a seizure. So if things change even a little bit, the only way you're going to know if it affects you is if you do have a seizure, so the result's catastrophic. Now, the question would be, why would switching from brand name to generic be different? The FDA says that generic is essentially equivalent to brand name. The problem is in the essentially. The FDA allows a tolerance between about 85 and 120% of the brand name. So if you have brand drug X and generic drug Y wants to market this drug, then as long as generic drug Y is between 85 and 120% equivalent to brand name X, then it's acceptable. So for some people with epilepsy, even changing the blood level between that 85 and 120% of normal or expected can result either in a seizure or side effects. So that's really the crux of the problem. Now you could say, well, that's fine. I'll just switch to generic Y, and as long as I always take generic Y, you'll know where the level is, and that'd be okay. Well, that would be fine, except your pharmacy switches among Y, Z, A, B, C, and every other generic of your particular drug that you're taking. And that's where it becomes unpredictable, and that's where it becomes a problem. So for some drugs for epilepsy, it's important to take the brand name merely so that you can know exactly how much drug you're taking each time. And that'd be true regardless of the condition.
Right. And my understanding is, from my homework here, is generic substitution is an issue that, as you mentioned, for high blood pressure, for epilepsy, happens across the board for a very large percentage of the medications that are out there.
That's true. The generic substitution takes a number of different forms. In some states, the pharmacist is allowed to directly substitute a generic drug without telling the physician and without telling the patient. And that, of course, I think is clearly a problem. In Virginia, pharmacists are not allowed to do that. They must have the approval of the physician, and I think that the new law is that they have to notify the patient. So in both regards, the problem comes about from insurers, because your insurer says you can take whatever you want, but if you want to take brand name, it's going to cost you $120 a month, whereas if you take generic, it's going to be $4 a month. And so while they don't really force you to take generic, they make the cost for taking brand name prohibitive.
Yeah, and we got a caller. Let me grab that. But one of the things that happened to me was we switched from the brand name to the generic, and they kept it at the same price. I'm like, what? What? All right, we have a caller. We have Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi. I have had epilepsy since 2003. And been under control on and off over the years. And just recently, within the last week, I've been having seizures in my sleep. Two one night and then one last night. And I just wanted to know if there was any significance to epilepsy while I'm sleeping.
Seizures can happen at any time of day, whether you're awake or asleep. The significance to having them in sleep has kind of a practical significance in that they're usually less of a problem because you're not driving or doing something else during the day that would be a problem. Often it's your bed partner or someone else who would notice if you have one while you're asleep, and you wouldn't necessarily know the difference. So in that way, it's not as bad, I suppose, to have them while you're asleep. There are certain kinds of seizures that are more likely to happen while you're asleep or certain causes of epilepsy, but overall it wouldn't quite have that great significance. For people who only have seizures during their sleep, they may be allowed to drive during the day, and because driving is such a big part of life for most people, at least in Virginia, where we don't have much public transportation, that's usually the biggest impact. So it doesn't have a biological impact that we know about why you'd have them while you're awake or asleep, but it has a certain practical impact.
Right. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Thank you for calling, Kelly. And best of luck dealing with that. 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. Dr. Nathan Fountain here as we talk about epilepsy. Call up if you have a personal question, a family question, or just looking to be slightly more educated on the topic. Go ahead.
I should have also mentioned to Kelly that people with epilepsy really should feel like they're able to achieve a state in which they don't have seizures, that the medicine is controlling it, and they don't have side effects. So certainly if Kelly's done very well for a long time and now had a few seizures, she certainly should go see her doctor, her neurologist, and talk about what might need to be done to control them. And often that would mean simply increasing the dose of the medication. One frustration in treating epilepsy, think about this for a moment for all of your listeners. The only way you know if the medicine's effective is if someone doesn't have seizures. And that means that as seizures crop up and they come back to see us as physicians, we say, oh, okay, well, now we have to increase the medicine. Think about if you had an infection like that. It just doesn't work for antibiotics like that. If someone has an infection, you give them this amount of antibiotic for this many days, and either it works or it doesn't. If it doesn't work, you move on to the next one. If it does work, then you've been cured of the infection. Whereas for seizure medications, all you can do is increase the dose. And that really speaks to what we need is better treatments. And fortunately, there are a lot of treatments in development, some of which are really very clever, that hopefully will get at some of those issues.
11:32 here on the Wake Up Call. I need to take a moment and thank The Backyard, University's Culinary Secret, at the end of Elliewood Avenue. The Backyard invites you to enjoy outdoor patio seating in their heated tent provided by Commonwealth Event Company. Backyard has a seasonal menu and seasonal brews on tap and is available for private events. For more info, call them up 202-8215 or you can find them on Facebook, The Backyard. Dr. Fountain, and I see the phone line ringing again. Bring it on, folks. You were talking about finding the proper medication. Why isn't it okay to find the medication that prevents the seizure if there is a small side effect that goes with it?
Traditionally, that's the way a lot of people have thought about, a lot of patients have thought about, and even physicians thought about treating seizures. And I think the thought process might go like this. Now, this is not my thought process, but I think the thought process of others is that, well, if you're having seizures because your brain's having an electrical storm, I need to give you a drug that's so powerful it's going to prevent the seizures, and consequently it must affect your brain at the rest of the time, and therefore you're going to have side effects. But that logic is flawed, because we have medications that for the vast majority of people with epilepsy they can take to keep the seizures away without causing other problems, which I think to some people might seem kind of magical, but fortunately it's the case. So we now have medications that can do that, and even the traditional medications generally could do that as well.
Now you're spreading the cough. I have one too. Well, you know, how many medications are there for epilepsy for the patient, the family to try?
14 is the succinct answer. We now have 14 different medications. Up until 1993, there were pretty much three drugs. It has kind of an interesting history. The first discovery of first treatment of epilepsy was bromides that everyone's familiar with. It's kind of, you know, there's a common phrase, well, maybe less common now, but historically common phrase about something's just a bromide for the public, and what that meant was a sedative. And in fact, bromides were sedatives that also helped prevent seizures, and that was discovered in the 1860s. And until 1920, there wasn't really any other treatment. And then Dilantin, a common medication, was synthesized in 1920, and then phenobarbital just after that. And between then and about 1995, between 93 and 95, there weren't other developments. But since then, so in the past about 15 years, we've had another 10 medications. There are 14 different medications. But despite that, about a third of people with epilepsy aren't controlled, meaning they still have seizures. And so now we have some very clever new devices that are just in development.
Dr. Fenton, we've talked a couple times up until now, earlier in the hour, about the difference between children and adult as sufferers of epilepsy. If it's, and I'm sure that my logic is flawed, you see, it always seems as though that's something that's genetic in some way. How does the brain change so that as someone who does not suffer epilepsy as a child begins to be bothered by epileptic seizures when they're an adult?
In most cases, it's because they've acquired something, some subtle thing that's either accumulated over time or some dramatic thing. So, for instance, people that have seizures after head trauma, they've acquired the head trauma.
Right. That's always the first question that I'm aware of is, have you had a head trauma? Have you fallen on your head? Have you been hit in the head, et cetera? But I wasn't.
Nope, and most people aren't, in fact. A lot of people have what we think are subtle changes in their brain, let's say microscopic strokes, or accumulation of abnormalities. And that's probably relatively easy to understand. But there is another group of people that have a genetic epilepsy that doesn't express itself until adulthood, called juvenile myoclonic epilepsy. And these are people that are perfectly fine until they're about 14 and they start to have convulsive seizures and brief little jerks. And fortunately for these people, 85% of them are controlled with medication. So it's really among epilepsies to have is usually relatively better. And the question is, why when you're 14 or 15 or 16 do you start having seizures you didn't before? And it probably has to do with normal brain physiology. One really great thing for me about studying epilepsy is I get to study a lot about brain physiology. Neurologists, clinical neurologists, even neuroscientists study a lot of aspects of the brain, but there aren't very many specialties where the electrical conduction of the brain is so important like it is for epilepsy. And the reason for those people with juvenile myoclonic epilepsy, for instance, or certain other genetic epilepsies, that they develop it later is because your brain probably has a series of transitions of different kinds of receptors. And, of course, you know this because your children, when they're young, are sweet, and then they reach adolescence. And then they get this encephalopathy of adolescence. They get they become little crazy people until they get through adolescence, and then they develop yet another personality. And so, of course, that's a crude generalization example, but it illustrates how the brain changes over time, and one of the changes is these changes of receptors, and epilepsy is fundamentally an abnormality of receptor conduction in the brain.
Another reason that it's incorrect to view epilepsy as the disease, is the disease the right word, of the child?
No, we've started calling it the epilepsies to illustrate that there are a lot of different things that cause it. It manifests a lot of different ways. The only thing they have in common is that they have seizures. This would be like saying someone has a cough disorder when they have lung disease. It really doesn't make sense. So we're now starting to call it the epilepsies because there are so many different things to call it by. But whether you call it disease or disorder, I think probably is less significant.
979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free number. Talking about the facts and I guess the fears and the mistakes, the errors of epilepsy and the thought process that goes with it. Dr. Nathan Fountain, UVA professor of neurology. Call us up with your question, 1138 here on the Wake Up Call. We've been talking about the medications that go with it. I discovered where the FDA says that anti-epilepsy drugs may increase suicidal thoughts.
That's right. The FDA did a review of their own analysis of randomized controlled trials. In other words, studies in which subjects with epilepsy are either given the actual drug or given placebo to see if those who receive the actual drug have a greater reduction in their seizure frequency than those who get placebo. Because remember, placebos have effects, and even people who get placebos get better. So in these studies, it appears as though suicidal thoughts were much more common in those people who were assigned to get the drug than those who were assigned to get placebo. So at face value, this would seem obvious. You'd say, okay, this was a simple analysis, and here's the conclusion. But there are a lot of problems with this analysis or conclusion. The first one is that everyone in these studies were already on seizure medications. They're already on anti-epileptic drugs. So why adding one drug after you've already been on others would increase suicidal ideation doesn't make any sense. The second problem with it is that this was across many drugs, probably about six or seven different drugs that were studied. So why would you think a drug that's has a particular mechanism that's effective for seizures would be similar to another entirely unrelated drug that's an entirely different mechanism? Really doesn't make sense. So on the one hand, if we think this is possible, we definitely should warn people who take these medications and their family members that if they have any suicidal thoughts or their family members notice anything to suggest that, they definitely should contact their doctor. On the other hand, I personally think that suicidal ideation caused by seizure medications is relatively uncommon. And in fact, although we've been talking about suicidal ideation, the FDA also analyzed completed suicides. And completed suicides in those studies of almost 10,000 people were very, very few. Something, I think it was 8 out of something like 20,000. So I'm not sure those numbers are accurate, but it was very few.
11:40 here on the Wake Up Call. Caller, we have somebody on holding. Please stay with us for a moment. We had someone calling online, too, while a little busy moment. Call back, 979-0919. We are talking about epilepsy with Dr. Nathan Fountain.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markets of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, behind the Kluge auctions. Many Kluge properties were auctioned in 2010, and recently Albemarle House went to foreclosure auction as well. The Hook sits down with husband Bill Moses to discuss the money woes and what comes next. In the wake of the Arizona massacre, experts are weighing in on whether assassinations can be predicted or prevented. A look back at America's 83 assassins suggests it won't be easy. And two more car fires have the debate raging about cause and effect. The Hook, reminding you that restaurant week approaches. And let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support. They now feature the Columbia OmniHeat, a waterproof down jacket with 700 fill power to provide protection from wet and cold weather. Columbia Omni Heat jackets are available at Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, the outdoor store that knows the outdoors. And don't go anywhere, because at noon, Drew Thompson will be here for Les Temps Perdue, the best 80s and 90s alternative with bands like Replacements, Eurythmics, and Concrete Blonde. Brought to you in part by Orzo and the Visualite. Requests are always welcome on Les Temps Perdue. All right, let's get to our caller. We have Kathy. Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Rick. It's your sister.
Oh, well, hi.
I was calling. I had a question for the doctor. You know, we have an uncle in our family who has epilepsy, and then you have epilepsy. So would... I have a twofold question. Would my son then be have a larger risk of developing that? And if so, would there be a genetic test that could be done so that, if so, it could be, you know, something that you would be aware of before it manifested itself, you know, as a teenager, so to speak?
The first part of that question is, if someone in your family has had a seizure or has epilepsy, are other family members at increased risk? And the answer is possibly. In most cases, it's not substantially increased. There are certain inherited genetic epilepsy syndromes which the risk is very high, maybe as high as 50% in some cases. But those are defined syndromes. For instance, I spoke before about juvenile myoclonic epilepsy. That sometimes runs in families that is autosomal dominant characteristic. And you remember dominant characteristics are inherited by 50% of the offspring. So in some cases, that's the case. But in the vast majority of cases, it's not. Now, if you have more than one first-degree relative affected, meaning a brother, sister, or parent or child, then the risk does increase slightly for your children. But if you look at the big picture, the risk for epilepsy in the whole population, I said, was about 3%. And the risk, if you have affected family members, increases only very slightly to about 5%. So in general, the difference between 3% and 5% would be small. There aren't commonly available genetic tests to look for the risk of epilepsy. I mentioned before a genetic study that we're doing, something called the EPGP study, the Epilepsy Genome Phenome Project. In this project, we're collecting blood from people with epilepsy who are exactly like that, have a first-degree family member affected. We're going to try to sort out, is there some subtle genetic predisposition? So maybe in the future, there could be a genetic test, although we wouldn't really anticipate using it quite like that, but it might help us learn more about it. So the answer to the first part of your question is it's only a slight increase in risk, probably. And the answer to the second part is there a genetic test would be not generally.
All right. My guess is knowing that, sister, it didn't help calm her nerves at all.
Oh, no, no, no. I was just wondering, you know, it would be something that you would just mention to your, you know, primary care physician when he was in for a physical, and then they could just, I didn't know if they could just zap the blood and find out, but no.
Yeah, it's important to mention. Yeah, it is important to mention all of your medical history to your doctor because there are some subtle things like that. And, of course, part of our role today is to increase awareness about that. For most people, though, there is the commonly available genetic test.
All right. Thanks, Kathy.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Call in if you'd like. You don't have to be related. 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS, talking about epilepsy today, facts and fears and all kinds of things with Dr. Nathan Fountain. Nathan, we were that question led us to sort of blood tests or other tests to see if that happens, to see if you have it, if you have epilepsy. But is there a way to make it go away? I mean, aside from the medication, there's surgery out there, right?
That's right. For people that have seizures that begin in one part of the brain, that have focal onset seizures, which is actually the majority of people, if they're not controlled with medications, then surgery is often an excellent option. Now, the first thing when I say that everybody thinks is, oh, my goodness, you're not going to operate on my brain.
And that's exactly what I thought.
That's a perfectly reasonable thought, because no one should have surgery on their brain if they don't need it. On the other hand, for people with epilepsy, if they have the right kind of epilepsy and the right kind of problem, then surgery can be very effective and very low risk. The most common single identifiable kind of epilepsy is temporal lobe epilepsy. Now, of course, there's a zillion different kinds, as I mentioned earlier, but if you parcelate them out into their smallest groups, temporal lobe epilepsy is the most common single one. The temporal lobe is right behind your temple, and it controls memory. For people who have temporal lobe epilepsy, their memory is often already at least somewhat affected. And fortunately, your memory is represented bilaterally in your brain. And what I mean by that is that memory functions can be assumed by either side of the brain, so that all you need is one side for your memory to work right for most people. And consequently, removing part of the temporal lobe where the seizures come from typically doesn't cause problems. And it usually is very effective. So that 7 out of 10 people that have that kind of surgery are essentially seizure-free, meaning they don't have seizures anymore. And the risk to it is very low.
And you know that the people who are listening are thinking, well, the other 3, what happens to them? Do the seizures remain the same? Are things made slightly better? Or are now I'm unable to even, you know, live my life the way I used to?
The common phrase is, the people say, is, Doc, will I be a vegetable? And the answer is no. For those other 3 people, their seizures are either better but not gone, or they're the same. It's very rare for surgery for epilepsy to make seizures worse. And then they say, well, regardless of the seizures, back to my question, will I be a vegetable, Doc? By which they mean, will I have some severe problem? And the answer is no. Of course, any kind of unexpected catastrophe could happen, but it almost never happens or is very rare in this kind of surgery. So the risk of death or severe injury is less than 1%. There are some kind of annoying problems that can happen after surgery, like headaches or things like that that go on for a while. So it's not entirely risk-free. I wouldn't want to suggest that. But if you compare it to the risk of seizures, which is pretty high, then the risk of surgery is much lower than seizures for people who have this kind of problem, this kind of surgery. And, of course, even if they can't, let's say that their seizures arise in an important part of the brain that can't be removed. If it arises in your speech area or in your motor cortex, then we can't remove that because then you'd be either unable to speak or unable to move. So even in those cases, we have some treatments, some very interesting treatments. One we're just studying has just been submitted to the FDA, kind of a Star Wars-like device. In this case, wire electrodes are placed onto the brain or into the brain at the places where the seizures come from, and they're led to a tiny computer chip that's implanted in the skull, and it monitors the brain waves. And when it detects a seizure, it provides a little zap to that part of the brain to stop the seizures.
I think I might like to try that one. Seriously, 11:49 on the wake-up call. Let me thank Sugar Snap for allowing us to be here, offering gently used baby and kids items, including shoes and hats, plus maternity and nursing clothes. You'll also find locally made items and a kid-friendly play area is available while you shop. You can become a fan of Sugar Snap on Facebook or Twitter. more online, sugarsnapconsignment.com. Here in the studio with Dr. Nathan Fountain, director of the Dreyfus Clinic here at the university. Dr. Fountain, one of the things that there's a difference between a seizure and what is called an aura, correct? And I'd like you to break that down a little bit.
An aura is when a small seizure happens, small enough that the person having it recognizes it but has no external manifestations. And usually it's arising from a very small focal part of the brain. And if for most people it really is a seizure, but it's such a small seizure, it doesn't cause other problems. And the type of manifestations it has or what someone feels during an aura depends on where the seizures arise. So, for example, in the case of temporal lobe epilepsy that I mentioned before, the temporal lobe controls your innards, to sort of speak. It controls or is connected to how your stomach contracts or your intestines. It's also connected to your autonomic nervous system. Remember, that's your fight or flight mechanism. And so, consequently, someone might feel fear or the hair stand up on their neck or their heart race. Because it's connected to your intestines, some people just feel an abdominal rising, and that's kind of the best they can describe it, because after all, you're not used to suddenly your stomach doing strange things. So it's really just a microscopic seizure. That device that I mentioned has taught us a lot about brain activity, because suddenly we can monitor brain activity in people who are up walking, talking, doing their normal thing. And another thing we can do is that the device records the brain activity, and patients who have this device in can download it from their head to their laptop computer using a wand. So it's a telemetry wand they hold to their head, and it downloads it to their laptop computer. They then send it over the internet to a central server that I can look at. So I can actually see their seizure activity sometime later. So I can look into their brains and look at their brain activity, which is very helpful in understanding whether or not a particular symptom is a seizure or not, and help us fine-tune the device to respond to that. But the answer to your question is an aura is a very small seizure. Usually it doesn't go on any further than that. Sometimes it could spread to adjacent parts of the brain, and if that seizure spreads, then it can have a seizure that has greater manifestations. So a few people will have an aura followed by staring unresponsiveness when it involves a larger part of the brain until it finally involves the whole brain and they fall down and jerk all over.
How does someone suffering from epilepsy, how many patients do you have? Hundreds? Thousands?
Thousands. 2,516, because I keep track.
And somebody's out there shaking their head going, gosh, it must take forever to get an appointment. You have all types, from children to adults, from people who have had a limited number of seizures and who I guess might be on the low part of the trauma scale, and those who have some that would make the rest of us shudder with thinking about what has to happen, what has to go on in their life. How do people deal with the daily life issues of epilepsy? Driving. We mentioned driving earlier, but can people who are a little farther up the trauma scale live independently, and so on?
It does happen across a whole spectrum of severity and frequency of seizures. The first thing to think about is, do people with epilepsy have other brain problems? Because if they already have mental retardation, or they've already had a severe stroke or some other problem with their brain giving them other daily problems, then of course those daily problems are going to be more important than their seizures and interfere with their daily living. So I don't really think we're talking about those people. The question is, for people who are otherwise fine, in what ways do seizures interfere with their life? And if you ask people, not surprisingly, they would say it all fits into the category of independence, as you inferred. And this, in Virginia anyway, and in most parts of the United States, driving is the single expression of independence that bothers people the most. In Virginia, the law is you can't drive for 6 months after your last seizure, the theory being that if you're 6 months seizure-free, then you're unlikely to have one again anytime soon, and so it's okay for you to drive. So the first impairment in independence, to sort of speak, is being unable to drive. The second issue is that because in at least in central Virginia, public transportation is practically non-existent, unless you live in central Charlottesville, that then it's very difficult to get around, and that means it's hard to maintain a job. And the third thing that leads to then is social isolation. So some people with epilepsy feel socially isolated because they can't get out and do things, particularly if they live in a rural area. But yet, of course, they can live independently because they're otherwise fine. They can go to the store and buy their groceries and, of course, hold down a job.
But there are, hopefully, tens of thousands of people listening who just went, well, I don't want you out on the road, even if you've been 6 months seizure-free.
That's true. If you look at overall the driving record for people with epilepsy and compare it to others, they have a better driving record than the average, which also makes it, of course, a better driving record than drunk drivers and other people who are impaired. So somewhere along the spectrum, you have to decide when it's okay for people to drive. I personally think the six-month moratorium is good because there is an additional time that your physician, when you return to driving after 6 months seizure-free, it requires a form from the DMV. And on that form, the physician can decide if they think that's not long enough for some reason. And because seizures tend to recur, if they're going to recur, within 6 months, if they haven't recurred in 6 months, then statistically they're relatively less likely to.
11:55, we're on the wake-up call. Our last few minutes as we talk with Dr. Nathan Fountain about epilepsy. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS-FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Let me make sure to thank Ben Around Tattoos for allowing us to be on air today. You can find them in Charlottesville and downtown Waynesboro. They feature male and female tattoo artists. Ben Around Tattoos has thousands of designs available and can create work from a design that you provide. Ben Around Tattoos, downtown Waynesboro, Charlottesville at 701 West Main Street, online, benaroundtattoos.com. Dr. Fountain, we got a call here. I want to make sure to include anonymous caller. Experiences tremors, stuttering, vertigo, and lack of concentration. Could these be symptoms of epilepsy? Doesn't have good insurance that allows for extensive testing. And how would you test?
On the one hand, almost any symptom could be a seizure because, after all, I said a seizure is an electrical storm of the brain, and since your brain is how you experience the world, anything you experience in the world could be a seizure. On the other hand, it's also true that certain parts of the brain are more likely to express themselves as seizures, so certain kinds of symptoms are more common. And the first key to things that are seizures is they have to be intermittent. You have to be feeling fine, and then suddenly it comes on you and goes away after a minute or two, and then feel fine again. And that's the way seizures are. There are a few rare seizures that go on a long time or have different manifestations, but the first key is that they're intermittent and brief. The second key is that they would tend to have a number of symptoms that would go together with the part of the brain affected. So, for instance, if it's in your speech area, it would affect speech, and that would spread to the adjacent motor area, which affects your face and might make your face twitch. If it affected your hand and made your hand feel numb, then you expect it to make your hand jerk, too, because the motor and sensory areas. The particular symptoms listed by the caller wouldn't be things that would particularly make me think of seizure, but would be reasonable to consider if they're intermittent and come and go. The most common test we'd administer, you know, the most important thing we do is talk to people. So you mentioned the large number of patients I follow, but of course most of them fortunately are doing very well, and so we don't have to meet so often. But when we do, I hope that we give them enough time to talk about exactly what's going on. Within neurology, neurology in general still relies on talking to patients, unlike some other specialties it seems. And epilepsy in particular relies heavily on us. That's the most important thing. But among the tests we get that are also important is an MRI, which is an image of the brain that can look for anatomic abnormalities, for instance, things like a brain tumor or an abnormal malformation someone was born with, and then an EEG, which measures the electrical activity of the brain.
Just another minute or so left. Dr. Fountain, last question from me is, with who do you share this information? Right or wrong, I have announced this every once in a while out of what I feel to be need or just public sharing here, but someone who might be much more private in their concerns, who do you tell about your suffering?
I encourage people to tell whoever they feel comfortable with to start with. So, if, of course, the physician shouldn't be telling anyone but the patient, but for patients, for people with epilepsy, they should tell whoever they're comfortable with. Now, the people that are around them regularly should know, so in case they have a seizure, they can render aid. But I think that it's almost a universal experience that once people, even when they're uncomfortable with it, finally tell those around them that they have epilepsy, the people around them say, oh, gee, are you going to fall down now and have a seizure? And they say, well, no, I haven't in the past 10 minutes we've been talking or the past 10 years you've known me. And the person says, oh, I guess that's right. And so I think most people are accepting. There are, of course, important ramifications in society and for your work life, and people with epilepsy are protected by the Americans with Disabilities Act, so in their work life, they really should be protected from any kind of retaliation or retribution. So I'd encourage people with epilepsy to tell everyone that's around them and anyone else they're comfortable with. And, of course, in a wider perspective, the more we talk about it and the more people know, the less apprehensive people will be about it and the less stigma we'll have.
Dr. Fountain, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think it's an important topic, and as you go, I'd like to say that as someone who hasn't experienced many, many doctors, I find you to be a wonderful doctor in terms of bedside manner, along with, obviously, a nation that gives you high marks on your medical skills.
Well, thank you very much. I guess as a final plug, I'd like to say the Epilepsy Foundation, the National Epilepsy Foundation, is having a walk in March on the downtown mall, and it's a fantastic experience.
All right. Thank you so much. Drew Thompson up next with Les Temps Perdue. I'll be back next week.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday, and by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.